This talk on Audio Dharma is not actually a Dharma talk. It was given at the InterSangha 2013 conference at Insight Retreat Center on August 22, 2013. The speaker is Kim Allen, Buddhist Insight Network President.
Welcome, everybody. I hope the dinner experience worked well for you. And can you guys hear me if I talk in this tone of voice like this? Okay, great. Wonderful. So this evening is the time for us to kind of begin with the conference program and start getting into the topics that we want to talk about over the next couple of days. And what I'm aiming to do in this presentation is to give an overview of a number of things and touch on a lot of the themes that we'll be talking about in this conference, kind of weave them together. And I'll apologize in advance that I probably have to go through it a little faster than it really does it justice for the time that we have, but you're all going to receive these slides, so you'll have the opportunity to see that again. So I'd like to frame what I'm saying around these broad areas laid out here. So that we'll start with an overview of the Insight Meditation Movement, and I say that very humbly in that it's not something that can be described easily, but I'm hoping to say at a top level things that are common to what we practice here in this tradition. And then a little bit about the development of the movement, kind of where the growth edges are, that we have areas that we're exploring. And then the intentions and visions in looking forward. You know, what is it, where is it that we're going, and what is it that we imagine for our future. And then talk a little bit at the end, and I think it will be a brief segment, about Bin's role in all of this, and a little bit about what we're doing and, you know, what we hope to be able to offer. So the broad frames around these questions I've put in the upper corner: what we know, what we question, and what we intend. Kind of things that we can wrap our minds around when we're thinking about a large topic like this. So beginning with the Insight Meditation Movement itself, what is it that we know about what we're doing here? If we actually had to sit down and somebody said, what is it that you do? Who are your teachers? What do you teach? How do you do it? What would you say? And I have to say again, this was not easy to do. So, but I could say that you know, we have a set of pioneering teachers. If we go back, you recognize the faces, I think, Joseph and Jack and Sharon, and Christine and Christopher and Ruth Denison. And these were the teachers who established the first retreat centers. That was really how our practice began a number of decades ago. It began as a retreat practice. And then the Insight Meditation Movement is characterized by the fact that these teachers are all lay teachers. We don't have founding monastic teachers in the same way. We'll talk a little bit about, of course, the relationship to monastics, but that's one of the characteristics. So we have the pioneering teachers. We have 70 or 80 retreat teachers that have been trained by these pioneering teachers. In fact, 26 new trainees just began in January 2013. They've been running this program every 4 to 6 years for the last couple of decades. And then there are other Insight teachers that are in this tradition but were not trained through this program. There's a handful of those also. So this is a rough chart of lay Insight teachers in the West. I just counted them up from inquiring mind. And my sense is that it's growing. And I also, just to be clear, I checked out also with Gil, who's considered, you know, an accepted Insight teacher who leads residential retreats. And we're up to something like 138, plus or minus. And that's included. The West means North America, Europe, Israel, that kind of area. So if that's who's teaching us, what do they teach? And the Dharma of the Insight Meditation Movement is even harder to, somewhat hard to characterize, although maybe not. Many people are familiar with this book by Jack Kornfield, which is the new edition is called Living Dharma. And it describes 12 Theravada teachers in Asia, who were often the teachers of those pioneering teachers, who who have come and started the movement here. And they're different. If you read through those practices, they are not teaching the same way to practice. But if you read the book with a sense of what's common to all of this, I found a theme that runs through all 12 teachers' teachings, which is that you practice the four foundations of mindfulness in order to see, have insight into the three characteristics. That's what they teach. They argue about concentration, they argue about what you need to do that. But this is, if you had to say what's common to all of them, that would be it. So maybe there's kind of a formula of, you know, you practice the four foundations, which tend to give insight into anicca. That's what's talked about mainly. But then there's this progression towards all three characteristics, which is the path leading to realization. How's that for a summary? Now you're all got it. That's all you need.
70 new free teachers.
So that's the roots. That's what it comes from. That's what fed into what these Western teachers are teaching. So what is it that we have here? Again, I would argue that the core teachings come from one sutta. Come on, this is a test. The Satipatthana Sutta, MN10. So that was the right answer. So we know this, and you know, these are the foundational and progressive instructions that we would get on the basic Vipassana retreat that you go to in the West. Now, how this has been taught is different and has changed even within our movement. What was being taught at a standard Vipassana retreat in 1985 is not like what's being taught in 2005, for example. And I'm not going to try to characterize that too much more precisely than that. But there is a progression from the roughly, broadly, the very strict Mahasi style to things that are now much more open, have a different flavor to them, based on students' needs and development of the teachers themselves and so forth. So even teaching from a core teaching can look a lot of different ways. There's also a flowering over the decades of other mindfulness practices, also other practices themselves. Metta practice is quite well developed now in our tradition. Concentration practice is just starting to be much more developed. And other kinds of practices are coming in. We have a richer spectrum than we did several decades ago. And there are also inclusion of teachings from other traditions. It would not be quite accurate to say that we are merely an extension of Theravada Buddhism. Probably not quite accurate, but that's clearly the root. So moving on to the sanghas, the places where these teachings are taught and practiced, definitely what we have is distinct from Asian sanghas. Compared to Asian sanghas, we have much less hierarchy, more democracy and egalitarianism. I don't want to just read them all, but much more inclusion, less ritual, and much more emphasis on meditation, certainly, than compared to what goes on in the average sangha in Thailand or Burma. But what we have here is also distinct from U.S. churches. You know, we haven't quite evolved communities that are like that. And also distinct from other spiritual settings, such as yoga centers, tend to have almost more religiosity than something like a yogurt center, but less than a church, say. It's, you know, what is it that we're doing? It's interesting. A lot of different things coming together. The numbers on this chart, I don't think it really bends over like that. Again, I got these from Inquire in Mind, but there was a little bit less, over the most recent years, a little bit less capturing of all the data. So I think this actually goes up higher. We have probably over 200 sitting groups in North America. And we would like to have even more listed in our database. So please tell me about other groups that you feel fit into this insight tradition, and we'll try to get them, try to collect them. We'd like to have a real log of that online, so it's a real resource for that.
Strictly Vipassana?
I mean, groups that would self-identify as being part of this tradition. So this shows the growth in the number of retreat and community insight centers, meaning groups that have their own building, their own property, or are the sole long-term tenant in a place. So basically a center that's devoted to this full-time. And you can see that You know, we had just a few at the beginning, and they tended to be more the retreat centers. And then there's been an explosion in the last decade or so of groups that are more of the community center type, having their own property and becoming real sort of solid foundations, 24-hour, 24/7 places to practice the Dharma. Diversity, this is growing, and it's growing slowly. And I would say there's been quite an effort over the last 13, 15 years, you know, beginning in the late 90s, it really became more serious, especially with retreats. So interestingly, that just like this practice started as a retreat practice and then grew into the sanghas, the retreats were the first place that diversity was really attempted to be integrated, with people of color retreats and other specialized retreats for certain specific and affinity groups. And then this year, there was a real effort to bring more people of color to the three-month retreat. And this year's three-month retreat at IMS is expected to have about 35 people of color sitting each of the 6 weeks. So maybe a total of 50, something like that. This is information I got largely from Larry Yang, who's done a lot of the energy and work towards changing these numbers. We have some sitting groups listed in our database that have these qualities. This is a finer level of detail than is listed in Inquiring Mind. We want to make sure we have these qualities available for people who are searching for that. If you know of others, we'd love to know. Number of teachers is growing, with the possibility of a teacher training that's focused for people of color. And then there have been additional publications and staff diversity trainings that are beginning, that have been evolving over time. But for all of that effort, it's interesting to look at the data. Again, this came from Larry, of the percent of people in color in various Spirit Rock programs. So the teacher training program, the numbers are so small that it's not so statistically significant exactly what number you get to there. We're talking, you know, these early trainings have 5 people, 8 people, 12 people, that kind of thing. When you get up to that, when you're in that level, it's hard to say. The DPP is a much larger program, and that tends to hover around the 5 to 8% level. And you can see that the most recent CDL was where so much effort was put in. It was 38% people of color, and that was really because that was the thrust of that program. So as usual, this is a case where there has to be a lot of energy in order for this to come about. Recruitment for that program began 2 years in advance. So that was a really broad characterization of what we do, who teaches us, where we're at. I hoped that I gave it at a top enough level that it was things that we could all agree on. And I would like to not only explore that, but also maybe some areas where there are differences during the rest of this conference. But I hope that at a broad level, this kind of sounds familiar to everyone. I see some nods as I'm doing this, so this is good. So then, given this thing that we have, it's not static, nothing, everything changes. And so there's development, there's growth, there's dynamism going on in this movement that we have. What are some of the growth edges and questions that we can see from this point going forward? One of them is our understanding of inclusion, and I'm now using that term more broadly than it's sometimes used for diversity, for example. Inclusion and insight, meaning what practices does a group begin to include that begin to say, okay, that's a little bit outside of what we would call insight practice, and I don't have anything to say specific about that, except that we have always had loose and porous boundaries, which has been a strength in growing the insight movement. Always, you know, the inclusion, the great, you know, start a group, start a sitting group, do what works in your community, bring in anything that you can, learn from online, all these things. But at the same time, we don't have a central religious authority in the same way that says what particular things are, nor would we probably want one. But given that these are qualities, the question is, how can we get folks to cooperate, to have a shared vision, to have some kind of unity, where is the value or the balance between anything and everything, and actually we'd like to be kind of clear about who we are. I think we all play with that in our personal lives also, who we are and who we aren't, and how much you want to define that. So these are questions that become relevant when moving towards something like a metta sangha, something like these groups starting to talk with each other, and starting to communicate about what it is to be an insight group. So this is an edge. Another edge was brought up earlier is our relation to the Theravadan monastic sangha. Clearly our roots coming in, and yet the Theravadan monastic sangha is not very strong in the United States, at least. And I put this picture on to characterize it. Why? Because this is what it looks like. This is the Spirit Rock International, which is the International Vipassana Teachers Meeting that was held at Spirit Rock this year in June. And so what do you see? You see lots and lots of lay teachers and a few monastics. And that's what we are, right? We have lots and lots and lots of lay teachers, lay practitioners. We're a lay movement. And then we have a few monastics who come and teach us now and then. A lot of people show up on those weekends when they come, and it's really interesting and inspiring. But they're a small percentage of the teachers that we have. And how do we relate to that? How do we support each other? Do we have a shared understanding of what we're teaching, or are they teaching something different than what the lay teachers teach? These are not questions that have any clear answers to them, but they're wonderful to explore. And I really appreciated what Wynne brought up earlier when she said, how can there be more mutual understanding, and is there a tendency to be dismissive on both sides? You know, do monastic teachers sometimes think that lay teachers aren't quite as qualified as they are? Do lay people sometimes think that monasticism isn't quite as relevant for their lives? It's a very different relationship than happens in Asia, and it's interesting to explore what that is and what we want it to be, because we have a choice about how it is. So another edge. Relationship to wider society. We work very hard to create our sanghas, and I know that takes a huge amount of effort and energy to go just to get those people together and run something every week. And then at some point, though, we start to ask, oh right, we're in a neighborhood. What do we do to support our community? Or do we have aspirations to take what we've developed on the cushion in our practice and use it to benefit society more broadly? And how do we do that if we're going to do that? And who do we say we are when we go out there? This is something that's much more developed in churches than it is in what we are developing in insight. So these are another edge. I have lots and lots of examples. There are lots and lots of isolated examples of groups doing things, and we're going to hear about some of them. We have a whole panel of people that are involved in compassionate action work coming up on Saturday. And I think this is another area where groups can, and people have different relationships in groups to how they want to do that for themselves personally, how they want the group to relate to that personally. So it's an interesting question. This picture I have, by the way, is a trash cleanup that was recently done by Against the Stream. The person holding one of the people holding the shovels is Mary. And it was just an area in their neighborhood that it was an eyesore. People dumped stuff off the freeway there, and they kept looking up the street. And finally they said, why don't we just go clean that up? And they told the city they were going to do that, and the city brought refreshments and supplied shovels and all the stuff. They combined with a local church, and it was great. And it was a fun Saturday project. So, easy. Okay. Another edge. So, given that we have a certain core of what we're doing, and then some edges around which we're still exploring and growing and changing, the question then is, what do we want that to look like? What are the intentions? What are the visions for what we could be, what we could do? And in particular, I'm going to bring in this notion of heartwood. This is the same picture I had on the first slide. It's a lovely image that's often used in the suttas, actually, to mean the most valuable part of something, the most excellent, essential, can I say that? part of something that's nourished by having a lot of stuff around it, supporting it. the heartwood of a tree grows strong because there's leaves, there's branches, there's bark, there's softwood. All that has to be there for there to be the heartwood in the center. And are we aiming at that? Is that our intention? So one vision that we could have, I'm just going to offer a couple broad areas for your consideration, is that the inside movement can aim to serve people along all stages of the path. So how broad can we be? One is that in a horizontal direction, at a given sangha, you have people with a broad spectrum of interests. You have people who are there because their lives are stressed and they want to have stress relief from the crazy, busy working world that they're in. You have people who are in recovery and really want to bring in their Buddhist practice to support that process in themselves. You have people who aspire to be monastics. You have people who want to go on retreats. You have people who want to start book study groups and learn more about the suttas. How to appeal to all, how to capture all of that. If you're in a big enough city, you have all of that in the same place, maybe showing up at the same time on your sangha evening. And so kind of how to meet all of those folks where they are. The Dharma can meet anybody where they are. That's one of its wonderful qualities. But how can we manifest that through our groups? So that's an interesting question. In addition, we might ask more vertically, or how do we serve people along the whole human lifespan? We now have people who might be born to parents who are Western Buddhists, and they're going to grow up in that tradition, like people grew up as Jews or Christians. Do we serve people their whole life? Do we have kids programs? Do they just have to wait until they're old enough to go to the Monday night sit, or old enough to go to a retreat? Or do we have something for children, something for coming of age, something for people who are getting married? Do we have marriage ceremonies? Do we have things for working people, and then things for aging people, and then hospice, all of it based around the Dharma? Most groups have not quite evolved to the point that they can offer all of that within their group in a way that a church could, for example, a well-established church. So this is something to consider as a vision as to whether we might want to have that kind of broad support for people. And then maybe a question for us is, I framed it as banana tree or oak tree. Does anybody get that reference?
Yeah.
So the banana tree is offered as something that is coreless. Of course, it's offered as the anatta image, but I'm using it here as an image of something that doesn't have any heartwood. So it has the leaves, it has the branches, it has the stem, etc. But there's really nothing in the core of a banana tree, whereas an oak tree has everything the banana tree has, and it has the essential part, the hardwood. So I have a couple of quotes to support this choice that we can make. Do we include, and I'll be specific, do we include awakening in our teachings? You know, is that something that is explicitly offered for the people who are interested in it? So from Joseph, this is when I interviewed him earlier this year. He says, there's some danger of making a sense of well-being into a goal in itself. Of course, having a greater sense of well-being is a positive and helpful development in our lives, but it doesn't necessarily lead us to the highest possibilities of freedom. So it's fine to serve folks for whom this is their path, their interest. And in addition, I asked further, well, can a student who's seeking awakening find appropriate teachings from Western insight teachers? And he was very clear. He immediately said, oh, yes. Within the spectrum of what's being taught, notice that he then said there's a spectrum, within the spectrum of what's being taught, there are teachers who really hold to the idea of enlightenment and awakening as being the core of their practice and teaching. So this is hope. This is hope, but it has to be tended and continued deliberately. So I'd like to move on to the last section, which is the role of bin and what we're working on. I've been developing this image of the tree as we go along, and I see bin as something that helps connect everything together in order to nourish that hardwood. So the leaves, the branches, the bark, the softwood, all that has to be unified into a functioning tree in order to grow that strong hardwood in the middle and support that. So I have to admit that the first image that came to me was the sap, and I didn't really like that image. So we're going with the photosynthesis process. It's a little better, sounds like, because that light involved, you know, things like that. So, sorry if I'm not very good at images, but that was the best I could do. So the support of sanghas and practitioners is something that Ben has already begun. We share information for insight leaders and sanghas and diverse practitioners on our website. We've been trying to offer organizational guidance. We would like to put together an ethics and reconciliation council for groups that have conflict or need for mediation of some kind. We're putting together publications already. We've got a couple on our website, and we have another one that's coming this weekend. And in the future, we would like to have the means to offer financial support in various ways to groups that need it, once we gather those resources ourselves, of course. And then, looking ahead, we see also that it's very important to support the teachers of this movement. So insight teachers, we would like to offer teacher meetings or host teacher meetings. Of course, they already happen, but you know, if you like the way this meeting is run, we'd like to run a teacher meeting also and help them connect together. Ongoing training, deeper study in suttas, Pali, and Buddhist studies, so bringing in those lineages that we're coming from, offer teachers a way to get deeper study in that. Funding and support for other kinds of their practice and teaching. Now, there's quite a broad spectrum of teachers and sanghas to support as we look out there. I was noticing recently, I added up the core teachers that are at Spirit Rock, IMS, and Gaia House, which are kind of the main retreat centers that, you know, that were the founding retreat centers of this movement. And if you add them up, of the teachers there, you get 57 that are on their teacher councils. And the total retreat teachers, remember we said, was around 138. So these are not a majority of teachers that are strongly associated, based at a retreat center. And yet, there's, you know, all these other retreat teachers out there who are not supported in that way. So there's also insight teachers who were not trained in these programs, you know, are not associated with these centers in a direct way at all. And then in addition, there are many sanghas out there that don't have a regular teacher. You add these up compared to the 200 plus sanghas, right? So, I mean, some of those are led by CDL teachers, but some don't even have that, they're peer-led. And so, how do we support all of these? Well, we would like to say that BIN can aim to support all of these different groups, and that would be, you know, that would be our intention. So, things that we've been working on lately, I mentioned the Sangha database earlier, and we're about to put up a new section that's on environmental dharma as kind of an example of an action in the world kind of project. And we'll have other sections related to other ways of acting in the world, compassionate action. This book I alluded to earlier on the five hindrances, essays and exercises, we're going to be distributing that later. And we've changed our newsletter recently to we're calling it a journal instead, and it has a new name, Heartwood. that's why we have the theme. We hope also to have a retreat database. It would be nice to have an online retreat database of insight retreats that's searchable, so you want to find out all the retreats that are happening in June of next year, or all the retreats that are happening by a certain teacher. Searchable, we'd like to have all that online. And of course, to support all of this, we have a need for various volunteers in particular areas, and our aim is to be more specific about our volunteer needs in the coming time period, so that it's very easy for people to plug into things that fit for them. So I like to think that what we're offering with the Insight Meditation Movement and its growth is a real development of Heartwood in the West, this fantastic looking tree. So rich resources that are made available to groups widely, make it easier to run your group, make it easier to start a group. Shared understanding and visions, meetings like this where we can talk with each other, find out new things, generate that kind of collective wisdom that's going to support us as we go forward. Support in return for a broad spectrum of communities and people. So ways for people to further their own practice and their own support of the Dharma, including everything, the leaves, the branches, the bark, the softwood, the hardwood. It's not that one is better than the other. They're all totally necessary. It's just whether we include all of those. So this is something that we're aiming towards. Thank you very much. We have a little time for questions or comments. Anybody has any at this time? Yeah, Jim.
You had a slide about Dharma's effort supporting the website development. Any more information about that?
Oh, sure. I'd love to advertise. Steve Swartz is a member of the Dharma Zephyr Insight Meditation Group, which is part of one of John Travis's collection of sanghas. And he has been our web developer over this time. So when you go to the website and you see it there, that's his handiwork.
Where is that tree?
You want to know where this tree is on the image? It's in some gardens, actually, in Great Britain, I believe. It does have an interesting history, but it's not relevant right now. I'll tell you sometime. Yeah, Karen.
Maybe this is a little more specific than you want to get into, but you know, I've kind of been wondering about the whole aspect of youth programs or insight play, or that sort of thing. And when you say we're thinking about that, who's we? I mean, like you?
Well, you mean this is the idea of supporting somebody over the entire lifespan. I say we, usually I've meant that term collectively, so I know that there are a number of sanghas that have started family programs, for example. Common Ground has some, IMC has some. They're just getting started. We even had a session a couple years ago about people who wanted to figure out how to do that. And I know that everything I've mentioned in there is something that's been thought about at particular groups and implemented in small ways somewhere. I didn't say anything that was a total fantasy. So it's been implemented in small ways in various places. So collectively, we can say that we have all of that, but it's not available in any one center completely. So that's something we might work toward. And of course, it hasn't been worked on together in a way that there's a collective understanding of what that is. So it's a lot of piecemeal, this and this and this.
So if someone came up and said, I want to get married in Sangha, what would you say?
Well, there's a number of options for them. Actually, there are ritual ministers that have been created through Spirit Rock. There are a number of other Buddhist chaplains or ministers that have gone through the training and development programs that exist, like at Sati Center, for example. And we're also at a very sort of rich and experimental stage where something like that, if the teacher has the credibility and acceptability, can make it up, you know, can be created. They were all made up at some point, all these rituals that seem like there's these bastions of tradition, they were made up at some point. So we can do the same. And that will be a fascinating conversation to have. And I think it'll evolve organically over time, but only if we start talking about it and doing it intentionally.
I just wanted to talk about family stuff. Jai Ashmore studied with Christopher Titmus, and she brought out this retreat. Next week is going to be doing the first retreat for people of all ages, which is a
wow.
Spectrum. Yeah, just at the Camp Delaware here in the South Coast Mountains. So, if you want more information. And also the Dharma Yatra, and a lot of those folks also study with Christopher in the UK and in France, happens every other year, and that's an amazing experience for people of all ages as well. And it's walking meditation over a number of weeks and people camp. So there's a lot of cool stuff happening across the spectrum.
Great. Thank you for sharing that. Bruce, I saw earlier.
Yeah. I was wondering, do you see online community tools like forums and groups and things like that as being a tool that you'd like to be using in what you're doing?
Yeah, I think there's possibilities for that. I think, of course, in person is richer. I know that you mentioned you brought these elements both together when you were talking earlier about that. But What I would say is that Jin has offered an online forum after a couple of the recent meetings that we've had, and people got on it for a little while and then it faded. That's how it usually goes. So there are successful examples of online sanghas. I would point particularly toward Gregory Kramer's relational dharma work. He's done amazing work in terms of getting people organized into groups that endure and even practice together over Skype because it's relational practice. So there are some examples, and I think it will always be an important part, but probably not the whole of experience. Or do you have a specific thing you're asking?
I guess one of the things that just caught up in my mind was, are there opportunities to share best practices or questions? Gosh, this is going on in my summer right now. I'm looking to develop this,
Actually, you touched right into something that we just talked about at our last board meeting, which was, why doesn't BIN offer monthly forums that people can sign up for? And we would address various topics. Maybe it would be a training in some kind of organizational development, or maybe it would be an input session of come and ask your questions about such and such and share with other people, and they would have a specific topic to them. So we'll just spontaneously ask, if BIN were to offer something like that once a month on specific topics, might you or someone from your sangha sign up for something like that now and then? So a few hands. Yeah, maybe half of you. Great. So we'll try to put something together and do some test runs on that and see how it goes. We'll learn over time.
And I don't know if it would maintain sort of cohesion, but if there were just some kind of an existing forum, a place to be able to ask a question, I've come up with this issue in my sangha, or, where a best practice is shared, or something like that. If that was out there and available, I would hear that. That would be
great. Yeah. Thank you. Ed, I saw you.
Can you tell us what Buddhist Insight Network aspires to do and some of the things that it's doing? Who or what is the BIN exactly?
We've had that question a couple times. Apparently we're not so good at the marketing aspect. Branding, not so good. So currently, BIN is a board of 7 people and a number of a few extra volunteers who help with that also. And it's also all of us. I consider the Buddhist Insight Network to be everybody who wants to be part of it, who comes to meetings like this and participates in the life and the development of the Insight Movement. Yeah. We'll do like 1 or 2 more.
I just wanted to make a comment. There's also an advisory board for BIN, too, right?
That's true. Yeah, we have an advisory board of teachers that are listed on our website. It's about 8 teachers from mostly Spirit Rock and IMS, but also a couple outside of that. Great.
I had a question about I've noticed from last year to this year, there are more people, and at least it seems like maybe there's not many people, but it seems like there's more people. I'm curious about tracking the network as a resource, so how often people are going there and getting information. Do you track that?
Do you mean on the website?
Yeah, the website, right.
That's a good question. I think we're not currently set up to do, well, no, that's not true. We haven't analyzed it very carefully yet. We could do that.
The reason I'm asking is that seems like the place where this information is held.
Yeah, our hope is to have the website be something like an online archive of relevant information for the Insight Movement.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's phenomenal. It's great. It's exciting.
Last one, Scott.
Do you have any more information on demography? Because I have kind of noticed having been to Spirit Rock and other meetings that the average age of people who are showing up for Monday or Wednesday night sittings tend to be close to retirement age on average. And I've sort of focused my workshops in areas where there's a younger demographic. And I've been involved in the Insight Meditation Movement for over 40 years now. And I know that the movement is great. And so I'm putting my energy toward the, you know, successive generations, particularly. I wondered if there is any demographic information that you have, or you discussed this with the in the BIN board.
Yeah.
How any outreach kinds of programs or just thinking that you've done on this?
That's a great question. In the presentation that I gave last year, I did show some demographics of Spirit Rock retreats over time. And it's actually been remarkably stable. The people who are close to retirement age are often the ones who have enough money and time to be at retreats. Now, it's true that there is a general shifting, and you know, you see things like now this Heavenly Messengers program in Spirit Rock, which probably couldn't have happened 30 years ago because there weren't enough, right? At the same time, where you're putting your energy, I see that happening in other areas also. The group where I practice, Insight Meditation Center, has started a program for people in their 20s and 30s that meets monthly. Also, this particular demographic of Spirit Rock teacher trainees that just started, a big effort was made to get the youngest people that they could to some degree. So I would say that I think both of what you said is true. Yes, there's a graying, and there's also this energy going toward younger people. So we could talk about that more this weekend, though. Maybe you brought up another edge, is how do we reach a younger generation? I think the hope was that younger teachers who look younger are going to appeal to people who are younger.
Well, Dharma Punks, who leads
sure,
there's a number of cities, yeah. They really have gotten a traction in a different demographic, and it's the conversation is about the same. And I was very heartened when I went to a couple of their meetings to see the interest. Mm-hmm. And I also felt the kind of the raw experience of the leadership, not too dissimilar from what we were like 30 years ago. So it was really great to see. But I see it's there, and I wondered what Ben was thinking about that. And I would love to hear more about it.
Okay. Okay, in the interest of time, I won't give you a long answer, but I think maybe that's something we'll look at later this weekend. Yeah, we really do need to stop. So that was the case. The reason why you don't want to stop is that we've got now 2 more days to talk about all these topics that have been opened up. And so we need to move on. In fact, it's now time to bring all of you into this conversation. And the next session, which is scheduled to start immediately, but if you need a bathroom break, that's okay, is going to be led by Dawn Neal, who is going to take us through some group exercises that help us begin to bring our voice into these particular issues and set the tone for what we're going to start on tomorrow morning.